This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In May of 2016, I hosted National Book Award finalist Ada Limon, along with Sonoma County poets Gregory Marr and Julia Vos, at the Word Temple Poetry Series. I'm going to play a recording of that reading right now, and I'm going to leave the introductions to how they were given that night. Enjoy. All right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Word Temple Poetry Series. It's so good to see so many people here, especially because it's our last reading until the end of the summer. Hopefully, we'll be back in the fall as usual. I'm Catherine Hastings. I'm the host here. And we are going to have another wonderful evening of poetry with three really terrific poets. Ever since Julia Vos's poem Papa's New Clothes came out in an anthology I published as my Poet Laureate project. Ever since I read that poem and heard her read it, I've wanted to hear more of her work. And she's going to open for us tonight, and then we'll have Gregory and Ada. So, you know, I was telling Ada before we started tonight that I'm so happy that I get to be so selfish and invite the people I want to hear to read here. Luckily, because of this series, I was able to ask Julia to come back, and you too. I also got to learn a little about Julia that I didn't know about her. It turns out that she is the author of Moved Out on the Inside, which was published by the Figures Press, and she's the winner of an Academy of American Poets Prize. Her poems have appeared in Deep Down, This is Women's Work, Changing Harm to Harmony, Bullies and Bystanders Project, which was edited by Joseph Zaccardi, who is also here tonight. It's a great book. Digging Our Poetic Roots, Poems from Sonoma County, American Poetry Review, Marin Poetry Center Anthologies, and the list is, it just goes on. She has taught or consulted poetry writing at San Francisco State University and UC Extension, and she was a writer in residence at Mount Zion Hospital, which I have to talk to you about because I worked there for 10 years. I wonder if we were there at the same time. And she's also taught with California poets in the schools. So please welcome Julia Vos.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for providing Word Temple for all of us. It's been a privilege, and it's so fun to be a part of Word Temple. Such an opportunity. Well, I have an invocation for this evening. What would happen if one woman told the truth of her life? The world would split open. Muriel Rukeyser. And I have another. She had some horses she loved. She had some horses she hated. These were the same horses. Joy Harjo. In the name of the bee and of the butterfly, amen. Emily Dickinson. I'll read a couple of poems from my book, Moved Out on the Inside. Unmoney, my love. Our fleece changed hands so many times we thought it was money. Blood we had is holy, bread and honey. If there must be tools, hammer, nail our eyes shut in the beginning. The Simple Funeral. The old horse drips pennies from his eyes. Someone has tied a stupid pair of horns to his head. Rhino horns. He is the only one we can ride to the living. This is one of my earliest poems written in graduate school, and since Ed Coletti and I were there together, I'll dedicate this to him. Letter to myself when I am older, with an epigraph from Wallace Stevens. I am the necessary angel of earth, since in my sight you see earth again. Whose smooth apple are you, taut, so oil shiny, bursting forth tart sweet juice? If I bite you, red and deep black red, no candied apple, not you. I see you sitting on a table in a dark room. What strange house! I spread my lips over cold glass and lick it, cool and tasteless. See you. No, I cannot break this window. I leave saliva, my greasy nose printed. You know I saw you. Mae West's dream. My pet toucan has won your mustache away, hijacker. The worm of your explanation is dead news. I'm in love with three more men. The black hand comes to me in the swimming pool at night. I tell him this could be possible. At this moment, a pilot has lost his face in my living room behind my calico egg. But now I am outside my house, awakened by someone kissing my front door. He is wrapped in my garden hose with gigantic eyelashes. Big boy has returned. I am a giantess and carry him in. This is a Native American-inspired poem. Ways she knew a handful of stones. She faced bright sun and tossed them, a handful of stars flung wide and far, hard rain sudden and stopped. She placed them in a small circle and stood in the center. She became a sunflower, ever so slowly following the sun with her face. She put them in a circle, three times as wide as she was tall. Now at the center, she floated off with the birds and the clouds, and she could descend to the molten magma core. She lay on the ground and poured them over her face. She poured them over her hair, over her feet, her knees, her belly. She put them in a cup, covered it with her hand and shook them. She moved her feet to the sound. She moved her head to the sound, her shoulders, hips, elbows. Inside some stones were crystals. Inside some stones was clay. Inside some stones were shells. Inside some stones was bone. Inside some stones were teeth. Inside some stones was hair. Inside some stones were bees and ladybirds. Inside some stones were her great-grandmother's 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 great-grandmother's. Ways she knew a handful of stones, too. She said to the stones, "Be so many, be my house." And they whirl in the dust and mist of the morning. At noon, her stones shone bright and hummed. They were her art house. All about flew hummingbirds who made the sound of telephones ringing, and she laughed because she always answered them, just thinking into their song. The house was made of her stones, and the children of her stones, and their children. She could feel the pressure of the original stones, the stones in her hand. We are here with you. Remember what is above and below. We will become warm and quiet in your hand, just as you wish. Throw us out as your wishes, and we will be a handful of black crows. We will be your black crows, and we will go looking. We will ride in the tops of pine trees and call down to you what we know. We belong to you. You belong to us, and so do the crows. We belong to the earth as it should be. Thank you. It is good. The young woman with her bald head said, this is from an encounter with a woman about to become a Buddhist nun and go to live in Japan. The young woman with her bald head said, magic rites must be performed before the parts of anatomy, that their doors will open, reveal the interior wall skin, its furniture, atmosphere, its people, their ways, moods, the air they breathe, the animals they pet, world in eyebrow and fingernail, world knee-backed women. They climb to the top the long thighs, understand animal tit, man tit, woman breast, the substantial weight, wineskins tied to her chest. Her thought depends upon the grapes that year ultimately, the weather, the willingness of the workers, whose animal fertilizer. The animal breasts barely there, but her ears stand out. She could be a boy. She is a boy. She feels like a boy. She combs my hair as she would comb her own hair. She gets married tomorrow with no hair. Now it will grow forever. He will see her bare head and know her heart is fragile. She has no hair to hide her. Her cool, wet fingers at the back of my neck. She braids my hair. She feels as strange as I do. In the braid she ties a small bell and pieces of turquoise. She ties her belt around my hair, a chain of hearts and clover she is supposed to give to me. When I go, the bell sings, see what she has done, after me. Step why? Step I love you. Step what do you want? Step, step, her eyes can't see me now. My hand makes no damp fingers in the mirror. She plays the drum and goes away. She is my brother, comes gentle. She is my brother, has breasts. She is the hairless infant I may care for. Everything I say, I touch her smooth head. She is the stark new thing I've been waiting to happen. And that's enough. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure I agree that that's enough. That was a beautiful reading. Thank you, Julia. Do you have books with you tonight?
Pardon?
Do you have books with you tonight?
No, I just have the one that I brought.
Okay. Well, talk to her afterwards. Thank you so much. All right. Tonight is a really special night here because we have a local Sonoma County poet with his first full-length collection out. And we have been waiting for it for a very long time. He's such a fine poet, and it's been very frustrating. I don't know about him, but it's been very frustrating for me and for some other people who know his work to wait for this book. It's here. It's here. It is called A Provisional Map of the Lost Continent. And if you are a lover of books and how books are made, one of the first things you'll notice about this book is its size, the dimensions of the book. It's almost square. It's very similar to the shape of the chapbooks I've published with a Small Change series. And it gives the poems so much room to just spread across the white space without fear of a paper cutter. It's really a beautiful production. So, you know, the first thing I noticed about this book. And if you decide to flip the pages of this book, you'll notice three stunning monotypes like this on the inside of the book. And there are images by a Northern California artist by the name of Harry Frank, and his website address is in this book. Greg's poems don't need the monotypes, but they are so beautiful that they can't do anything but kind of extend the greatness of these poems. So they really, really are nice in there. So a provisional map of the Lost Continent won the Poets Out Loud Prize, judged this time by New York poet John Yao. And in his comments, it's clear that Yao was deeply impressed by the imagistic and, in my mind, just right on the edge of some surrealistic imagery in the poems. He noted how scribbling clerks, horse carts, and confectioners coincide with glass towers, climate-caused sea rise, and species extinction. After a quote like that, and after reading passages about birds flying backwards, dogs barking backwards, a storm of lit trees, things like that, you get the drift that this is not necessarily a light-filled collection of poems, but there is light. And there is that thing that, if it were allowed to rule the world, would possibly save it, and that is art, the art of poetry. His poems pose so many questions that need to be answered, and here I'm tempted to quote from a poem of his called Fandango, but instead, I already gave him a very strong hint to read that poem tonight. Okay, I have my ways. This is really an incredible collection, and as I said, one we've been waiting for years. And you're about to hear some poems by Gregory Marr. Please welcome him now.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's been a wonderful series you've had here for the last 10 years, and I'm glad to be a part of it. You know, when you gave the introduction, it made me think about blurbs, and I think in some ways maybe this collection is in part about the distance between the blurb of self and the self. And that's one way to possibly describe it. I think I'm going to start with an epigraph from Donald Barthelme. Thank you. So Donald Barthelme, thus I found myself in a strange country. This Paraguay is not the Paraguay that exists on our maps. It is not to be found on the continent South America. It is not a political subdivision of that continent with a population of 2,161,000 and a capital city, Asunción. This Paraguay exists elsewhere. The first poem, Ciudad de Oro. Washed against other alluvial bodies, we waited centuries for the rains to end. North was still beyond our reach. South had not yet been assigned a star. Our muskets remained as invisible as hooves buried deep in the bodies of whales. We crossed a series of valleys still short of the interior. We were left to wonder what, if anything, could be built of sturdier air. Navigation requires a backward glance, but our helmets were heavy as we approached the capital. No matter the vector, we remained at the outskirts. Much of the city was underwater, a gush of pale letters and torn urns. To a man, we felt the bruise of place missing its address, the far district strung together by imagined filaments, broken and hungry horses sinking beneath the column of air. What voices remained read as iambic shout. It was like sifting through swans and ashes for the one bitter penny, finding several. The spill of moonlight was that close upon us. We could still feel the places in our bodies where the Pleistocene had lain down its long ribbons of mud. In the unsettled light, we made camp and set about perfecting the maps. Within their gilded borders, the world we had left behind, only wider at the isthmuses and subject to revision. Next poem is Drift. I'm a guest among small swarms of winged insects, their vernacular rough against my skin. I've left the long cursive of your body to strow the Miocenian grasslands, skittery in the powdery light. One epoch is dying into another. You can hear the buzzing against the glisten, stars wheeling in a broken halo. Suddenly all I want is to become aquatic, to return to that watery place where drift is a form of propulsion, and we little more than bell and tentacle. Votive shudders gathering in the outer precincts, our future tiny and invertebrate. So, you know, this collection is collected by a series of, connected by a series of somewhat imaginary cities that don't seem to adhere to any time or particular place. This poem's called Red City. Go toward the red city, they said, and we went toward the ground, rose up against the stubborn dark of noon. Find where the sevens are sown. We searched inside the throats of 13 swallows. What we heard, that everything growing here vying toward theoretical blue, proved false. The minutes continued to fall about our sloping shoulders, cuffing our ears like iron kisses. In the impended churchyard, we traipsed arm and fist among the twitch and lurch of sprung earth, green camouflaging green. The elders must have known the city was on fire when they loosed vandals from their armoires. Where their library once stood, fragments of the 12 known plot lines, a few loose files to take the measure of what was lost. From here it was a short jaunt to the confessional, but the booths were full, and besides, what was there to confess other than the same tattered narrative? Once I resided among kettlefish and barricades, etc., etc. Thinking back, salt was too good for us. Pumice and ash will register the silhouettes of our fabulous lives. Small squalls wrapped in paper mache. The muzzled pronoun that is I. And by the way, the artist who did the monitor is right here. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Where is he?
Somebody once described my poems. I like the description that it was like sending out search parties that then got lost, and then other search parties were sent out to find those search parties, and going on. I'm sure I'm part of one of those search parties. Hinterland, there was a specific place I had to pass through on my way to the thin longitudes of marshland and spire. Only now does the sun confide its fractured alliance with the hourglass. Tell me more than I can possibly disclose. Tell me the cost of lying low while the canals run red with starlight. Put down your knife and walk with me beyond the drifting cisterns. Of the three names for drowning in brackish water and the one enduring word for exile, which shall I choose? There is no longer a twice to go back to. Stay with me in the weak sunlight of old empires. That adjacent world where everything, even extinction, is still waiting to be invented. I was going to actually read fewer poems, but Catherine made me promise to read more. I don't know if my voice will last. I'm going to try to add a few more poems, but it won't be forever.
Oh, thank goodness.
Travelogue. Outside the frame, shimmer wants our attention. An inland sea, a high window, the crushed spectacles of a minor poet. The narrator does not specify. It could be Madrid in 37, Antigua in late May. An urgency curls the day's images, which floats above us in the filmy smoke. Fluent in betrayal, the translator, a village priest, has locked up every vowel. Once I was instructed to hide myself in an underground empire of mason jars and boots. None of us knew then which of our lives we should keep or which country might desire our excellent services. If only my father had raised his voice or set paper saints ablaze in foreign districts. Who am I if not the shuttered window? I learned to sleep in separate frames, obedient to the smallest of vistas. When I say blood orange, I mean the fidelity of sunflowers. Story, the distance between sill and toppled chair. This next one is Refrain, another one of the series of city poems. Before a plan could be formalized, a town appeared, calamity of streets, dogs barking backwards, and a general washing of hands that led to more washing than something vaguely political like air balloons, barricades, and rumors of public weather. Gasoline ran the avenues, and word was that soon there would be music, and everywhere a humming or a clearing of throats, as if what was prophesied was finally upon us. So we hitched up our gabardines, grabbed the nearest oboist, looking for the precise angle of entry. What we heard was a distant tatter of songs arranged as a march, the loose syntax of warm rain, bees fuzzy with jazz, nuzzling the river azaleas. All along we'd wanted the next thing, and now that it was almost here, our attention turned to the waitress's narration of our town's architecture, its fallen porticos and maze of rambling rooms. It made us want to sleep in separate beds, followed by various unsponsored silences, so that nothing could disturb the popular music playing inside us. Nothing could disturb the music inside. I think I'll just read a few more here. You want me to read the ending? I never read that one in public, but I'll do that. In a moment. A provisional map of the lost continent. There are two of us then, errant Magellans, the sea or its rumor at our backs. Sand was the language we spoke. I have delay, you have circumnavigation. Where we should have been fluent, only dashes and stops. We'd wanted to be the first to discover the lost republic of Vosotros. You asked, who could slow the velocity of sleep or salt's migration? We had yet to speak of entropy's majesty, whether it was a circuit of high vicissitudes we were entering or oxidation's weave. Circumference is not a perfect circle. When you spoke of sea birds, a fog moved through you. For a long time, description failed to account for array or cluster. We appear in patches, flutter. Sail is not whole, but neither is it wave. A map of the wind, perhaps, a chain of words, an archipelago of blue and yellow birds. Beneath the sea, is there no other? The latitudes of amber release their languid thefts. A ghost continent hurries toward its shade. Excuse me, this is a Fandango. Into the tremble we twirled and lapped Fandango noon till night. Everything was wrong. The bog grass bent into the wind. Birds flew backward into the teeth of predators. The air smelled of fly ash and homicide. What is kindled here slips under fence lines, crossing from description into tremor. Panic is a shuffled chronology. First the death of stars, then the passerine nocturnes. Nature is a foolish, useless thing. Smoke will clear the trees of nests, burnish the grasslands, and the garland clearing a dirge nestles against his bride. Blurred sky, what can you offer now? It was always going to be a narrow escape, but now that no one is singing, who will sing the dark-eyed Junco to sleep? And I think because I only have one poem left with my voice, so I'll end with Afterlife. We remember the darkness at our backs, the spine of stars, how each memory was sifted and offered back to us from the ash of our bodies, how the night plow spilled its cargo of ice over the curved fields, murmur of smoke at the edge of the woods, a crucible of starlings, open sky. Now two more suns and the moon smaller by half. At the end of the day, another day. This is not the heaven we counted on, still so knotted to the blue world. We remain winter shadows, heat rising from rooftops, blade and bee falling endlessly before the scythe of the sun. Thank you very much.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's return now to the Word Temple poetry series. You just heard Sonoma County poet Gregory Maher read, that's M-A-H-R-E-R, and we are moving now to Ada Limón.
We have one more poet coming up here. Her book is Bright Dead Things, And when introducing Greg, I mentioned the cover of his book. And with Ada Limón, I have to say that the first thing that got me about her book was a poem on the inside flap called How to Triumph Like a Girl. And I thought, I made all these assumptions right away. It's like, oh, okay, I really like this, How to Triumph Like a Girl. And then the poem instantly takes this turn. It's terrific, and it's also the first title in the book. It roped me in, and I couldn't stop reading until I reached the very end of the book. And it reminded me how important creativity is. What would be lost if we did lose everything? You know, if humanity were to disappear, maybe it wouldn't be so bad for the planet, but our art, you know, we need our art. There's an epigraph for the book by the late great poet Larry Levis, and I love reading anything he's ever written. And this phrase really serves perfectly as an opening into Bright Dead Things. Who among the numberless you have become desires this moment, which comprehends nothing more than loss and fragility and the fleeing of flesh? And although this is Limón's fourth book of poems, and Greg is celebrating his first, it really seemed fated somehow that these two poets read together tonight. From A Provisional Map of the Lost Continent to Bright Dead Things, we move from physical and emotional landscapes that seem to blend into each other somehow. We find ourselves envisioning tattoos of Nebraska, carrots in Kentucky, fried pickles in Nashville, and more in Ada's book. We find ourselves discovering the lives and deaths of old loves, human and animal, and trying to answer questions like, where do you keep your sharp tools of history? And shouting yes to a realization that strikes at the end of a very hopeful poem called Miracle Fish. And here's another strong hint. Okay. The book is a real emotional roller coaster. You can go through a number of emotions within two pages of reading her poems. In one poem alone, accident report in the tall, tall weeds, you can move through several emotions within a couple of pages. I think all of the poems in this book make you feel something, or they make you think deeply about yourself. And so in these ways, it's a really, really successful collection of poems. I want her to read the entire book tonight, but we'll have to make do with the time we have, and then you can, I was going to say, you can take the book away to your own little landscape and improve it there, but she doesn't have her books with us tonight. So I'm sure she'll be happy to tell you how you can get them at the end of this. But right now, please welcome Ada Limón.
Thank you. I'm used to lowering the mic. I was like, Julia and I should read together. We wouldn't have to lower the mic up and down. Thank you, Greg and Julia, for those beautiful readings. That was lovely. And I'm excited to spend some time with your books. I remember meeting you at AWP in a one moment. It was a writer conference in L.A., and it was the one moment I had to eat. And Iris Dunkel had brought me pizza and lemonade, and I couldn't have been happier. It was the most amazing moment of that entire conference. And I got to meet Greg briefly. Thank you all for being here, and Catherine for putting this all together. I'm going to begin with a poem that opens the book, especially since today was the Preakness, which is the second race in the Triple Crown. This is a poem that is about the Kentucky Oaks Day, which is the day before the Derby, which is when all the fillies race. How to Triumph Like a Girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy. Like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger after winning. Ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies. As if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me. That somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart. Giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge, beating, genius machine that thinks, no, it knows, it's going to come in first. It's a poem for the ladies. About 5 years ago, I moved to Kentucky. I'm from Sonoma, California. I lived in New York for 12 years. And now I live in Lexington, Kentucky with my fiancé. And it was an adjustment. But I'm still learning to love it. I love it. And this is sort of a love poem, a complicated love poem about that time. The last move. It was only months when it felt like I'd been washing the dishes forever. Hardwood planks under the feet, a cord to the sky. What is it to go to a wee from an eye? Each time he left me for an errand, the walls would squeeze me in. I cried over the non-existent bath mat, wet floor of him. How south we were, far away in the outskirts, all the new bugs. I put my apron on as a joke and waltzed around carrying a zucchini like a child. This is Kentucky, not New York, and I am not important. This was before we got the dog even, and before I trusted the paralyzing tranquilizer of love stuck in the flesh of my neck. Back home in my apartment, another woman lived there, in Brooklyn, by the deli, where everything was clean and contained, where I grieved my deaths. I took to my hands and knees. I was thinking about the novel I was writing, the great heavy chest of live animals I had been dragging around for years. What's life? I made the house so clean, shine and shine and shine. I was suspicious of the monkey sounds of Kentucky's birds, judging crackles, rusty mailbox, spiders in the magnolia tree, tornado talk, dead June bugs like pinto beans. Somewhere I had heard that after noting the lack of water pressure in an old hotel in Los Angeles, they found a woman's body at the bottom of a cistern. Imagine just thinking the water was low, just wanting to take a shower. After that, when the water would act weird, spurt or gurgle, I'd imagine a body, a woman, a me. Just years ago, freely single, happily unaccounted for, at the lowest curve of the water tower. Yes, and over, I'd press her limbs down with a long pole until she was still. He says, that's a love poem. Oh, the curse of living with a poet. The quiet machine. I'm learning so many different ways to be quiet. There's how I stand in the lawn, that's one way. There's also how I stand in the field across from the street. That's another way, because I'm farther from people and therefore more likely to be alone. There's how I don't answer the phone, and how I sometimes like to lie down on the floor and pretend I'm not home when people knock. There's daytime silent when I stare, and nighttime silent when I do things. There's shower silent, and bath silent, and California silent, and Kentucky silent, and car silent. And then there's the silence that comes back, a million times bigger than me, sneaks into my bones, and wails, and wails, and wails, until I can't be quiet anymore. That's how this machine works. Poem about writing poems. This is a real love poem. Not the other one wasn't, but... And another poem about the struggle I had moving to the South. It was published in the New Yorker, and I was so nervous to read it out loud in my town of Lexington, Kentucky. So I have to preface this by saying I really love it now. I love it.
Sure.
State bird. Confession. I did not want to live here. Not among the goldenrod, wild onions, or the drop seed. Not waist high in the barrel-aged brown corn water. Not with the million-dollar racehorses, nor the tightly wound round hay bales. Not even in the old tobacco weigh station we live in, with its heavy metal safe doors that framed our bricked bedroom like the mouth of a strange beast yawning to suck us in each night like air. I denied it, this new land. But love, I'll concede this. Whatever state you are, I'll be that state's bird. The loud, obvious blur of song people point to when they wonder where it is you've gone. This is a poem that I wrote. A miracle fish is, are those, they come in plastic. And they can tell your fortune as you put them in your hand, and they, depending on which way their fins or head go up. Yeah. So, this is Miracle Fish. I used to pretend to believe in God. Mainly, I liked so much to talk to someone in the dark. Think of how far a voice must have to travel to go beyond the universe. How powerful that voice must be to get there. Once, in a small chapel in Chiayo, New Mexico, I knelt in the dirt because I thought that's what you were supposed to do. That was before I learned to harness the upward motion inside of me, before I nested my head in the blood of my body. There was a sign, and it said, "This earth is blessed. Do not play in it." But I swear I will play on this blessed earth until I die. I relied on a miracle fish once in New York City to tell me my fortune. That was before I knew it was my body's water that moved it, that the massive ocean inside me was what made that fish swim. The second section deals with the death of my stepmother. She died of cancer in 2010, and it was a home death, and I was one of the primary caregivers for that experience and for her transition. And I don't like to read too much from it because it's hard for me to recover from that section, so I'm just going to read one of those poems. After you toss around the ashes. When she was dying, it was impossible to see forward to the next minute. What was happening for whole weeks was all that was happening. That was happening and happening and happening. Months before that, I got the dumb soup wrong. How awful. It was all she wanted, and I had gotten it wrong. Then, in the airless days when it was really happening, we started to power panic that we didn't know enough. What should we do with her ashes? Water or dirt? Water or dirt? Once she asked to just be thrown into the river where she used to go, still alive, but not living anymore. After it was done, I couldn't go back to my life. You understand, right? It wasn't the same. I couldn't tell if I loved myself more or less. It wasn't until later, when I moved in with him and stood outside on our patchy, imperfect lawn, that I remembered what had been circling in me. I am beautiful. I am full of love. I am dying. I'll read a particular Sonoma County poem. It's a poem that takes place in Glen Ellen. When I was growing up, I used to ride on the back of my father's Harley, barefoot. And I think that would never happen today. Before. No shoes and a glossy red helmet, I rode on the back of my dad's Harley at 7 years old. Before the divorce, before the new apartment, before the new marriage, before the apple tree, before the ceramics and the garbage, before the dog's chain, before the koi were all eaten by the crane, before the road between us, there was the road beneath us, and I was just big enough not to let go. Hanno Road, creek just below, rough wind, chicken legs, and I never knew survival was like that. If you live, you look back and beg for it again, the hazardous bliss before you knew what you would miss. I'll read another horse poem. I'll probably read three more poems. It's a horse poem, but it's also about a first sexual experience. The speaker's first sexual experience. That's what we say in poetry workshop. The speaker. My grandmother is reading this book, and I think that she hasn't made it to this poem. I keep waiting for the phone call, but I don't think she's made it here. The Wild Divine. After we tumbled and fought and tumbled again, he and I sat out in the backyard before his parents came home. Flushed and flowered and buzzing, with the quickening ripples of blood growing up, and I could barely feel my hands, my limbs numbed from the new touching that seemed strikingly natural, but also painfully kindled in the body stove. Oh, my newness. Oh, my new obsession, his hands. I thought I could die and be happy and be humbled by luck of a first love and a first full-fledged. I wanted to tell my ma. I wanted to make a movie. I wanted to blast out of my bare feet to Skytown. As we passed the joint in the soupy summer's air, too spiced with oak leaves, eucalyptus, and smoke, I thought I might have a heart attack. Kind of craved one. Kind of wanted the bum rush of goodbye like every kid wants when they're finally on fire. Then, out of the stone breath quiet of the hills, came another animal, a real animal, a wandering madrone-skinned horse from the neighbor's garden, bowed back higher than a man's hat, high up and hitched to nothing. He rustled down his giant head to where we sat, baked and big-eyed, at this animal come to greet us in our young afterglow. He seemed almost worthy of complete devotion. We rubbed his long horse nose, his marble eyes turning to take us all in, to inhale us, to accept our now selves, as he was older, a wise, hoofed, grizzled equine elder, and I thought, this is what it is to be blessed, to know a love that was beyond an owning, beyond the body and its needs, but went straight from wild thing to wild thing, approving of its wildness. This poem is about also in Glen Ellen, set in Glen Ellen, the great blue heron of Dunbar Road. That we might walk out in the woods together and afterwards make toast in our sock feet, still damp from the fern's wet grasp, the spiky needles stuck to our legs, that's all I wanted. The dog in the mix, jam sometimes, but not always. But somehow I've stopped praising you. How the valley, when you first see it, The small roads back to your youth is so painfully pretty at first. Then, after a month of black coffee, it's just another place your bullish brain exists, bothered by itself and how hurtful human life can be. Isn't that how it is? You wake up some days full of crow and shine, and then someone has put engine coolant in the medicine on another continent, and not even crying helps cure the idea of purposeful poison. What kind of woman am I? What kind of man? I'm thinking of the way my stepdad got sober, how he never told us, just stopped drinking, and sat for a long time in the low folding chair on the Bermuda grass, reading, and sometimes soaking up the sun like he was the story's only subject. When he drove me to school, we decided it would be a good day if we saw the blue heron in the algae-covered pond next to the road, so that if we didn't see it, I'd be upset. Then he began to lie, to tell me he'd seen it when he hadn't, or to suppose that it had just taken off when we rounded the corner in the gray car that somehow still ran. And I would lie, too, for him. I'd say I saw it. Heard the whoosh of wings over us. That's the real truth. What we told each other to help us through the day. The great blue heron was there. Even when the pond dried up or froze over, it was there because it had to be. Just now, I felt like I wanted to be alone for a long time in a folding chair on the lawn with all my private agonies. But then I saw you and the way you're hunching over your work like a puzzle, and I think, even if I fail at everything, I still want to point out the heron like I was taught. Still want to slow the car down to see the thing that makes it all better. The invisible gift. What we see when we stare long enough into nothing. I'm going to close with a poem. When I lived out in Provincetown, Cape Cod, everyone kept seeing the whales, and I never saw them. And finally, I would just lie. And I just started to say that I had seen the whales. This poem about that. Thank you again. Lies about sea creatures. I lied about the whales. Fantastical blue water dwellers, big slow moaners of the coastal. I never saw them. Not once that whole frozen year. Sure, I saw the raw white gannets hit the wave so hard it could have been a showy blowhole. But I knew it wasn't. Sometimes you just want something so hard you have to lie about it, so you can hold it in your mouth for a minute. How real hunger has a real taste. Someone once told me gannets, those voracious seabirds of the North Atlantic chill, go blind from the height and speed of their dives. But that, too, is a lie. Gannets never go blind, and they certainly never die. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard Ada Limon reading from her book, Bright Dead Things. Before that, you heard Gregory Marr and Julia Vos. All three of these poets were Sonoma County poets one way or another, even though Ada lives part-time in Kentucky now. We have a little time left, and I'll have a couple of announcements in a minute. But first, here are Barbara Bonney and Andre Previn performing poetry that you will recognize by Emily Dickinson.
Thank you. conversation, a summer afternoon. Her household, her assembly, and when the sun goes down, her voice among the aisles incites the timid prayer of the minutest cricket, the most unworthy.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple. My guests today were Ada Limon and Gregory Marr, as well as Julia Vos. I want you to make a note on your calendar right now for the live Word Temple Poetry Series. The next event is Saturday, September 24th at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. I will be celebrating my own new book of poems, Shakespeare and Stein Walk Into a Bar. Lee Slonimsky from New York will be celebrating his new book of poems, Consulting with the Swifts, New and Selected Poems, 1982 to 2016. We'll be joined by Sonoma County poet Sandra Anfang. So once again, that's Saturday, September 24th, 7 p.m., Sebastopol Center for the Arts. I hope to see you there. And thanks for listening to tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.